I am going to read you the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the preamble. Whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. Whereas disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind, and the advent of a world in which human beings shall enjoy freedom of speech and belief and freedom from fear and want has been proclaimed as the highest aspiration of the common people. Whereas it is essential, if man is not to be compelled to have recourse as a last resort to rebellion against tyranny and oppression, that human rights should be protected by the rule of law. Whereas it is essential.
That was Eleanor Roosevelt reading the first few words of the preamble to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted by the UN General Assembly in Paris on December 10, 1948. This is Tidings, and I'm Hazel Kahn. Hernán Santa Cruz of Chile, a member of the Declaration's drafting committee, recalled his participation in what he said was, quote, a truly significant historic event in which a consensus had been reached as to the supreme value of the human person. And he described the atmosphere in the Great Hall as one of genuine solidarity and brotherhood among men and women from all latitudes, the like of which, he said, I have not seen again in any international setting. That momentous event took place 66 years ago today. To help us understand some of the developments in human rights around the world since then is my guest Bill Haas, who for 30 years served the United Nations Secretariat in a variety of capacities, mostly in news media-related functions, which included traveling on assignment in Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Bill is now president of the United Nations Association of Southwestern Connecticut. Bill, it's a pleasure to have you with us at WPKN on Human Rights Day.
Well, thank you very much, Hazel. It's a real privilege to be with you.
Thank you. At the beginning, we heard Eleanor Roosevelt reading the preamble to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I must say, it sounds very much like the American Constitution. Is that intentional?
Well, I think the American Constitution and also the Declaration of Independence were one of the bases upon which the Universal Declaration was created, and I think it built from there. I mean, there are several principles that are enumerated in the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, and also in the preamble to the Declaration of Independence. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the Universal Declaration, it says life and liberty are part of those principles that are expressed and codified in the UN document.
Right. It's no accident, I suppose.
Oh, no, no. I think the U.S. was a prime mover behind this.
Mm-hmm. Has the Declaration itself and the Articles actually been amended since 1948?
No, they haven't. But what has been done is the United Nations has created a body of international law, a system of international treaties and covenants which enjoy the force of law among the states who are states parties to these conventions. So a lot of the rights that are outlined in the Universal Declaration have since been adapted into conventions which carry the force of international law.
In the 66 years, how has it worked out?
Well, I think just to give you a couple of examples, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which was an outgrowth, one of the conventions that was established on the basis of the Universal Declaration, talks about equal pay for equal work, for example. And this is something that's starting to get more play now here in the United States about women receiving equal pay for equal work. And this is just a recent development, but it was already stated in the covenant. I think human rights is a work in process, a work in progress. No country is perfect in this area, and it's sort of an evolutionary process. The standards have been set and established, and now countries are working to realize those goals.
Yeah, I suppose you could say that the Declaration is an extremely idealistic document, and it's maybe reflecting wishes for man, for humans at their finest, what they would be if they were really good humans.
Well, I think so, but there has been progress. I mean, there's certainly been progress since this was established. Now, as you can see, many things that used to be accepted by the international community are now no longer the prerogatives of national states and governments. I think the recent genocide that took place in Rwanda motivated the international community to say that if a state cannot protect its own people from this kind of atrocity, then it's the right of the international community to help that country to protect these people or even to intervene should it be required in the affairs. And then before that, countries were pretty much had accepted the idea that whatever happened within the borders of a given country was not the business of the UN or the international community. So these things do have effect and impact.
So Rwanda was a turning point?
I think in this case, because the Rwandan experience has caused the Secretary General and the General Assembly to establish the principle of the responsibility to protect, in which the international community said that they had the right through a General Assembly resolution to intervene in such situations, first by trying to help the country to protect the people affected, but if in fact the government was culpable, to even intervene to stop the government from committing these atrocities. Now, of course, in the real world, this happens on a case-by-case basis. It's not perfect, but it did establish this principle, and of course, a lot of countries in the developing world thought that this was kind of an avenue for the developed world, the major countries of the world, to intervene in their affairs for other reasons, when in fact the real impetus for it was to protect the populations in different countries, regardless of where they were.
Countries, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit more later, are at all kinds of levels of development on the human rights protection scale.
Right.
So how, I don't know, it's such a big question, but if you could just help our listeners understand, how does it get then from these principles that are, you know, codified somewhere, to actually on the ground?
In the human rights area, what happens is these principles are codified into conventions. And, for example, there's a Convention on Civil and Political Rights, which guarantees freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, these kinds of things that we take for granted in the U.S. Constitution, and as well as other civil and political rights. The right to vote, to right to run for elective office, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And countries want to look good, so they want to aspire to these standards, or they want other people to think they are aspiring to these standards, at least, even if they're not 100% committed. So they will sign on to these. But once they ratify these treaties, and in the United States, of course, it's a two-thirds vote in the Senate where you ratify a treaty, and then it becomes binding on your legal system. And the same thing with other countries that decide to accede to these treaties. Once they do so, they are subject to evaluation by a panel of experts that are elected independently, and the country has to file a report. These reports are examined by the committee attached to the treaty, and then the reports are made public, and the countries are questioned and grilled sometimes on their human rights record, and this happens to every country that ratifies one of these treaties. So the countries don't want to look bad, so it's in their interests also, if they're not, don't really believe in these things, they try to look good, they don't want to be seen as violating these kinds of basic human rights. So there is progress, I would say.
What is the penalty for violating?
Basically, it's public exposure.
Is it shame?
Shame, and also if it's an extreme case of genocide, for example, mm-hmm. then there can be a military intervention if it's authorized by the Security Council. That can happen. And I think in the case of Bosnia, for example, Security Council could not get an agreement because of the veto of Russia and China. But in that case, the United States and the European countries chose to take action in response to a genocidal situation in Bosnia.
Is that also how people get to the International Criminal Court?
Yes, the International Criminal Court is something that the Security Council has to approve the referral of cases to the International Criminal Court. And the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights keeps statistics on alleged violations, genocide, for example, or serious violations of human rights, and they're doing this right now in the case of Syria. So in the future, once this Syrian conflict is over, there were several people that were referred, in the earlier case that I mentioned in Bosnia, the former Yugoslavia, to the International Criminal Court and were prosecuted. So it's an incentive for people to comply with basic human rights standards because the international community does keep track and there are mechanisms for holding people accountable, especially individuals, for these kinds of violations.
So how does it actually work? I'm just curious. You know, I know how AIDS workers or Ebola workers or, you know, people who give polio injections or shots. And I can understand those are people who are in the field with their equipment and their training. But how do human rights workers work at the grassroots level, or don't they?
They do. And what they do is provide technical assistance and training and also education. Education is very important in countries around the world, and we provide educational materials to countries, to children in schools, and also to the general public. If people know their human rights, they're much more likely to defend them themselves in their own country. But so education is the first thing. But then in the case of training and technical assistance, there are standards for the treatment of prisoners, and the principles for the treatment of prisoners or those held in detention for crimes and criminal behavior. And there are also standards for the independence of the judiciary that have been established by the UN. And the UN has experts that provide technical assistance to countries that are trying to develop a competent judicial system. So we have that kind of training capacity as well.
Then you are invited in as opposed to assert yourself into situations.
Yes, that's true. Country has to agree to that kind of thing and has to invite you or has to accept you if you offer to do it. Mm-hmm. But there are times when, for example, I was on a trip once to Africa, and the Secretary General asked my boss, who was the Undersecretary General, headed one of the European offices, he asked that person to intercede with the President of the government to release some people from prison whose only crime was being members of the former leader's family. Mm-hmm. And these people were released about 2 or 3 weeks after the intervention was made. Of course, there was nothing in the newspapers about it. We couldn't really take credit for it. It was an act of quiet diplomacy. But this is a real strength of the UN because the UN and the Secretary General's office have a lot of influence behind the scenes. And if they make a special request like this, it oftentimes will be honored.
So what is the strength that permits this quiet diplomacy? What is the strength? They have special passports, right?
We have special passports that are issued by the United Nations that are honored in most every country. UN staff work for the United Nations Secretary General and the Secretariat. They do not work for their national governments. So the fact that the United Nations is a universal organization of 193 countries gives it this weight of international public opinion and approval of the actions it does. Everything that the UN does is something that most or all governments who are members of the UN have agreed to and support. Generally, the UN's welcomed when it's asked to help, especially in Africa. I know people are very grateful for what the UN has done in Africa. And so most of the time, UN staff are very well respected and welcomed in these countries. But there are exceptions. I know our office in Islamabad, Pakistan was attacked because there is a standard that requires women's rights be respected, and this sometimes clashes with local cultures. The UN has been instrumental in trying to help with girls' education in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and UN people have been attacked, and some have been killed who have been involved in this.
I just also had wondered, what do you do with ISIS or Boko Haram? Is that just completely outside your jurisdiction? Do you not even try to get involved?
The UN is involved with these things for sure. But until you get an agreement in the Security Council, you can't take direct action, but the Secretary General has a lot of capacity to mediate, negotiate, and intercede politically and diplomatically. But as in the case of Bosnia, the UN Security Council was not able to agree on action, and in this case in Syria, it's not able to agree either because of basically Russia's veto. The UN can't take formal action, but some of the members of the UN can, if they choose to, they can assist the parties, and I think that's what's happening. And of course, the UN, with its humanitarian and refugee and human rights operations, is doing a lot to alleviate the suffering to the extent possible over there.
Let's just go to the 193 countries. How would you array them, organize them on a continuum in terms of human rights? Is that something that you can do, or that you have in your own mind? And what does better mean in any case?
Well, that is a very interesting question. I think the easiest way to explain the situation at the UN is that there are two fundamental orientations toward this. Many developing countries, the ones with low standards of living, feel that unless they have economic and social and cultural rights realized, such as the right to a job, the right to a decent standard of living, the right to an education, these kinds of basic things that are necessary for a civilized society and for the development of the human person, then they cannot really aspire to the civil and political rights, like the right of free assembly, the right to freedom of speech, freedom of religion, all the things that Western countries, European and the United States, focus on. So since the beginning, there has been this division between countries focusing on the economic side and the development side versus those focusing on the civil and political side.
Today is the 66th anniversary of Human Rights Day, and Bill Haas, who served at the United Nations for 30 years, is talking about the history and the current state of human rights among the UN's 193 member states. This is WPKN Radio.
So this is something that continues today, although more countries are becoming more aware of the need for both, because without a basic standard of living, you can't really think about some of the freedoms that we think are important. Things have to go together, and it's hard to evaluate different countries because there are cultural differences and different ways of interpreting these things.
To go back to what you said earlier, that the role of education in basically telling people that they have rights, certainly if you grew up in America, the concept of your rights is very pretty much well established. But for other countries, it just probably is something they don't even have any conception of.
I can give you an example of what the UN does to try to promote this. We have offices in about 67 countries around the world called UN Information Centers, and this is from my department, which was the Department of Public Information, and we have these basic documents like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. First, they're translated into all the official languages of the UN, Russian, Chinese, Arabic, French, Spanish, and English. From there, they're translated into local languages in different countries. So that way, we make these documents available locally to schools and governments, and sometimes we have a budget to do more, and sometimes we have less, and it depends a lot on the local country.
Can you tell us anything about where these principles and ideas find resistance? Is it a religious resistance? I mean, I just wonder why they need educating.
Most of these principles that are enumerated in the Universal Declaration are very lofty aspirations for all humanity, and they're supposed to apply to everyone. And all the countries at the founding of the United Nations, or shortly thereafter in 1948, did agree on this Universal Declaration. There were, I think, 51 members at the time. Now there are 193 countries, because a lot of these countries were colonies before. These are supposed to apply to everybody. Now, in local contexts, it's like democracy. We have a certain kind of democracy in the United States. And in Europe, they have parliamentary democracy, where the mechanisms locally to adapt to its own traditions and culture. So it can be interpreted slightly different on a local country-by-country basis, but the basic principle is governments have to be accountable to their people, and people have to have a voice in what their government does. You start from that, and then you branch out into these other areas. But the basic aspiration is there, the universal, the accountability of governments should be there.
How do you work with some of these? I mean, we've talked about other countries without being very specific. I'd like to start just in the last part of our conversation about this country, about the United States, where, you know, there are a large number of human rights abuses, whether you're talking about Guantanamo, which is not actually in this country, whether you're talking about, you know, voter rights, police abuse, which we've seen recently. And then, of course, the United States in terms of foreign relations, things like the drones or the rendition procedures, torture, all those things. Obviously, the United States is one of the most developed countries, so it's not really correlated with economic development, the human rights abuses.
In the United States, I should say that the good thing is that all this stuff is exposed. We know about it through the media and through the political opposition. All these things have come out, even when they were going on. And one of the reasons I think that President Obama promised to eliminate this practice, and he did, when he took office. And
which
I think
practice?
Even the torture and the renditions that was taking place under the previous administration. And I think even President Bush, in his second term, started reducing that stuff. So there, you know, countries do these things. They make mistakes. But the good news is here, we know about them. Some countries, they never hear about this stuff until 20 or 30 years later. So like I said at the beginning, no country is perfect. But at least here, seems like any kind of abuse that's taking place, we can see what happened in the Catholic Church. We can see what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. All these things are coming out. It's out in the open, and people have to deal with it.
Did your organization, United Nations Association, or the UN, or any of the NGOs like, you know, Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, do they get involved in things like that in this country?
I think Amnesty and Human Rights Watch do, yes. Mm-hmm. They do. And there are plenty of other organizations in this country that are involved in this, like the Southern Poverty Law Center that really keep an eye on these things, the NAACP. And fortunately, there's not much to stop these people from advocating for their causes. But any kind of change in a political system is a battle. And it's going to be a fight between opposing forces. And that's kind of the way it works. And that's just the way it is.
Well, what about a couple of other countries I'd like to ask you about? Let's take Bangladesh. And clear worker abuse in these awful factories, and climate change is really affecting them more than a lot of other countries. Do they have rights? I mean, is that something these NGOs get involved with?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of international NGOs that get... Remember, in Myanmar, they had a very autocratic government, and that government has transitioned and changed, and it's not perfect. There are persecutions of Muslims there by the Buddhist majority, but it's opening up, it's changing, it's moving in the right direction. Bangladesh, the fact that that factory burned down with those workers inside, textile, clothing manufacturing, and that really drew attention to the problems. They're under a spotlight, and they have to fix those problems, and they're moving in that direction to do that.
That's because of human rights organizations.
Well, I think it's also because of the media. The media exposure is so important. And that, of course, is one of the things Thomas Jefferson said in this country. He said if he had to choose between no government and the media, and the media and no government, he would take the media and no government. Because, you know, you want to have that kind of freedom of expression and ability to spotlight abuses and problems, and that's when people will demand change. It really has to come from the grassroots.
One country that I'd like to hear you talk about is what's going on in Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. Because there it seems to me, I don't know, maybe you can see progress there. I think many people can't. It just seems that the international community is really not very involved or very present or very effective in considerable abuses that are going on at every level you can think of.
Well, I should tell you that the United Nations for years, since the establishment of Israel, which was became a member state of the United Nations, but plenty of attention is drawn to the problems of the Palestinians and those in Gaza and the West Bank in the UN arena. In the General Assembly and then the Special Political Committee of the General Assembly. Also, the UN has, for years, provided refugee assistance to the Palestinian refugees, mm-hmm. education through the UNRWA, which is the UN mm-hmm. Relief and Works Organization for Palestinian Refugees. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is a domestic political issue in this country, and until you can get the Congress and the president to use their influence with the Israeli government and with the Palestinians, and
well, to some extent, it's up to the Palestinians too, and
it is,
you know,
yeah.
for their own leadership problems. But
one of the biggest problems, which is hard to deal with, is the settlements, the Israeli settlements mm-hmm. in the occupied territory. So there are just some very serious obstacles there that are going to take time, but it's not a hopeless situation.
Well, sometimes problems don't have solutions. But you, on the whole, seem to be quite optimistic. Is that a fair characterization?
Oh, yeah.
That you think somehow you believe that things will get better rather than worse?
Well, I think if you look at history, you'll see when you look at the fact that there were no human rights standards 66 years ago since the UN Charter, no real universal human rights standards before the United Nations was founded in 1945. And now there are lots. There are lots of international treaties, covenants, monitoring bodies, special investigators on thematic issues of human rights, as well as investigators looking into country-specific situations right now. World War II was such a disaster. 40 million people were killed in World War II, just an ungodly amount of suffering and horror, and that, I think, motivated the world to establish the UN and to look at what was causing all this suffering and to establish these human rights standards. And I think a lot of them never were articulated before. Some of them are based on the U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, which in turn were based on prior documents and writings of philosophers. But things like the right to equal pay for equal work, I mean, that was never articulated before. Are the rights of persons with disabilities, the Convention to Prevent Genocide and Torture. A lot of the problem in the past was that things happened, horrible things happened, but we just weren't aware of them. And now we're aware of everything, and most people don't want to accept these things, and so there is movement to change. But it takes time, and it's gradual, and it's incremental.
This has been very, very interesting. Thank you very much. If people would like to know more about your work, is there something you would suggest?
We're a chapter of UNAUSA. They have a website. It's unausa.org, and the UN website is un.org. If you're interested in getting involved in our programs here in southwestern Connecticut, you can certainly email me at hassbj@aol.com.
What is the kind of thing they might do if they got involved?
A couple of things we're involved in that are very big. One is UN Day. Every October 24th, we have a fairly big program at Norwalk Community College. We've done it in the past 3 years. And then the last Saturday in June in Westport, we have what is called June Day, where we invite about 300 United Nations staff and delegates and their families to come to Westport for a day of fun and recreation. And anybody who wants to volunteer for that can contact me.
Okay, well, thank you again. Thank you very much, Bill. I'm glad we had this chance to learn from you.
Great. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, I do too. Thank you very much, Bill.
You heard Bill Haas, 30-year veteran of the United Nations Secretariat, talking about the history and current state of human rights on Human Rights Day. You can hear Tidings on the second Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m. All Tidings programs broadcast on WPKN are archived at hazelkahn.com.